You're listening to Builderpedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
Welcome to the latest episode of Builderpedia, and we haven't recorded in a while, but I'm very happy today because we've got our first, I guess, celebrity guest on Builderpedia. So I'd like to welcome Anthony Burke, Professor of Architecture and host of Renovation Australia, amongst other things. So welcome, Anthony.
Look, thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Just wanted to apologize. I mucked up the time and I ran home and I just made it. And I'm like thinking, I think probably the most prominent guest we've had on Builderpedia, and I managed to be late. So I'm so sorry. I feel terrible to keep you waiting a little bit, but thanks for your patience.
We're all good. If there's one thing you've got to have in the building game, it's patience.
Absolutely. I probably shouldn't be even saying that on air because, you know, everyone would be like, oh, yeah, that's typical. But I do try very hard to be on time. I guess before we dig into more about Anthony and how you became a host of, amongst other things, Grand Designs, I wanted to see if you had an inspiration for us for this week.
Yeah, well, look, you've caught me at a really good time to talk about inspiration because it's O week right now at university, and I'm thinking of the semester ahead with a new crop of students. So to get the students going, it's all about revving them up and getting them inspired, even if it's just for a little bit. And like, these are 19 and 20 year olds, so it takes a bit of energy to get everyone sort of moving in the same direction, if you know what I mean. Everyone focused at the same, looking at the same thing. But my inspiration here is a beautiful, small, very short book that anyone can read. You can download it for free online. It's called In Praise of Shadows by Junichiro Tanizaki. And it's in English. Don't worry, it's in English, but it was written in 1933. And the whole inspiration here is it's a beautiful book that is really just a little meditation on what it means to think about design, not in terms of the materials, but in terms of the space between things and in terms of the negatives of things. So the darkness rather than the light, or the shadow rather than the sunlight, these sorts of concepts, which are really strong in Japanese philosophy and not so well understood in Western philosophy. But as a piece of writing, it's a really beautiful, very easily accessible, lovely little thing that always, when I come out of it, I keep thinking, oh, that's just so good. It just makes me want to do more design. It's great.
Yeah, because the shadows and the light and the things that fill it are the interesting bits.
Yeah, exactly.
And yet we're not, if you're designing something, I mean, there is technology that enables you to show that these days. Like you can actually render something in 3D and show light and show things. But that comes in after, right? It doesn't come in as a base for
Well, the renderings do. They come in after, but the whole point of the book is where you start designing from. In Western ideas, you start from where do I put an object on a site? And that's, Luca Borgia said, you know, it's all about the magnificent play of light and on objects, you know, and that's very much a Western point of view. But if you're coming from a Japanese point of view, the actual place where you start is not the thing, but the space between things. How do I create space and see architecture as something which creates that space or allows that space to happen? So that's the shadow. There's another word for it in Japanese. It's called the ma space, the space between things. And you can see it in Japanese architecture all the time.
And how prominent is that in, like, when we train an architect at UTS? Like, how prominent is, does that get sort of considered, and does that philosophy come into play? And I guess I'm, for disclosure, I'm a non-architect. I'm an imposter. I worked in architecture for a long time, but I've trained in construction and at UTS. So I remember O Week very well. Well, I remember some of O Week as a student. But yeah, I had some training in, it was called contextual studies when I did it.
Yep.
Which was the architectural subjects, but there was nothing like that. So I'm wondering, does that come into how we train our architects?
Well, actually, full disclosure from me too, I'm not actually an architect because I'm not registered as an architect, but I've worked in architecture and graduated from a master's. And all
we'll
that
let
stuff
you off
and,
with a warning. Now, so good.
Yeah, I'm a professor of architecture. I just don't want to get into legal trouble, you know.
Yes, yes.
And do we teach it here at UTS? Well, look, it's part of a big design conversation which runs right through the school from first to final year. And you're always looking at different ways to see into a design as it starts to shape up. And I don't think every academic or every tutor that comes in is talking this way, but I do think it's something that I find really important to help students see things from different perspectives. And this is a really great flip of the usual script from what they're used to, from what most of us would think of as the architectural thing, the object in space. But as soon as you start seeing the spaces and not the building, then you start realizing that the building is only a support act to make the spaces come to life. And that's where we exist, in the spaces. So, you know, it's kind of nice. It puts the building into a bit of relief, puts it into the background a little bit. It's kind of a, I used this phrase earlier today and I'm going to apologize for it up front. It's an infrastructure of experience. That's what an architectural object is. It's all about the human. It's all about the person and their experience. So architecture has to serve that. So if we put architecture in the background to make that the foreground, it's like this flip from solid object to shadow, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the brief is always quality spaces and quality movement through spaces. So that's the thing that I know, like, not only enriches lives, but enriches property values. It's how we feel when we move through a space, what emotional impact that has on us. That's, pull all your tile specs and everything aside, what's left is your, like, that is a small part of that experience. But the space itself, yeah, I've always, so in an odd way, I've never thought of it like that. But yes, in terms of principles that we aspire to, yeah, the quality of space is the primary thing. But I've never thought of it in a way that you've described, where it's filled with shadow. The shadow takes precedence over or has an equal, and I'm mucking it up now. you put it eloquently.
No, I love it. You're into it. It's great.
I'm fumbling my way through the shadows and the darkness and the light. But yeah, I get it. It's how it feels.
It'll take you an hour to read the book cover to cover. It's not a big book. It's a small little essay, really. So,
yeah. But it'll take me 2 hours because I'm a slow reader. But I guess where I wanted to start with is just tell us a bit about Anthony Burke, and particularly how you arrived at from architecture to hosting a TV show. Or was that always something you aspired to, or did it happen by accident? Tell us the story of how that came about.
Yeah, no, definitely very much by accident. Was never really on the radar as a career move at any particular point. But what happened was, as an academic, and I've worked both here for a long time at UTS now, before I came to UTS, I was at Berkeley in California as a young academic there. And before that, I was in New York teaching and studying my master's and doing a little bit of teaching after that. So seen a few different context. And of course, you're giving lectures to students all the time. And I remember, sorry, I digress here for a second, but I remember giving a welcome. I was asked to give a welcome to new students at Berkeley one year, incoming architecture students. And I was the youngest academic on the roster. I said, oh, well, you're the fresh young face of architecture. Why don't we put you up on stage and welcome the newcomers? So I said, yeah, I'd love to. That's an honor. Thank you very much. So I got up there and gave the absolute worst introduction to anything ever in the history of any lecture. I had prepared a script. I was super nervous. I was worried that I was going to not set the right tone for the entire school or represent everything in just the right way. And so I prepared this script and I read it, and I was as animated as I could be, but I stood at the podium and I read this thing. And my wife, she came along, she was in the audience. And when we walked home afterwards, she said, don't ever read from the script ever again. That was just awful. So at that point, I thought, right, lesson learned. Thank you very much. Threw the script away. Yeah. So you get used to lecturing. But then where all the TV stuff came about from was a buddy and I, or a colleague and I, Gerard Reimuth from Terroir, a great practice, an architectural practice, both here in New South Wales, in Sydney and in Hobart, and in Copenhagen, actually. He and I were asked to, or we applied for and got the honor of being the creative directors for the 2012 Venice Architecture Biennale and curating the Australian Pavilion, which is a real honor. I mean, it really is representing Australia at a very esteemed moment in international discourse, you know. So we took this incredibly seriously, as you do, as you would want to. But in doing that, we were all around Australia talking to lots of practices, and we got a little bit of media. So we were in the press a little bit, people wanting to write articles. Well, what are you going to do? How are you going to represent Australian architecture to an international audience? Did a few TV spots. And then after that, we were asked, both of us together, were asked to do a TEDx talk. And you can still Google that and find me on there doing the TEDx talk. And that little piece of video, that's done amazing service for me in particular, but for both of us, I suppose, is because that whenever anyone Googles architect media, that's when that kind of pops up. And so they can see, oh, well, let's get him on a shortlist. So I got on a shortlist to try out for Restoration Australia because the host was stepping away and they needed someone. So I said, yeah, that sounds interesting. Went and auditioned. And the audition was a little house in Randwick, and the secretary at Fremantle Media was the homeowner. And so I had to sort of do 15 minutes of discussion with the homeowner just off the cuff with a camera on us. Did that, and they called me back and said, would you like to do it? And well, the rest, as they say, is history.
So your Grand Designs is a new thing, right? You started with restoration. And I kind of...
That's right.
We were chatting about this the other day because I realized when I started watching, and no disrespect to anyone involved in Grand Designs Australia, but when I started watching the iteration of Grand Designs Australia, I realized that what I loved about Grand Designs was actually Kevin MacLeod. And I hated everything else about it.
And apart Kevin from has Kevin, a very big personality.
Experience. And particularly for a builder, because you're just going, oh my God, like this is just awful. This is just awful from the outset. Awful budgeting, awful execution, mostly just terrifying ordeals. And I know, like being in that and working in that, working closely, I know how hard it is to be in that spot and how hard it is for clients, even when things, when they don't end up with disasters like inevitably they do in Grand Designs. You know, at some point there's something, and typically, and my favorite one is, and I'm watching something going, I don't think that's going to work. And then the next, like a minute later, and the new experimental waterproofing system seems to have failed, you know, like that it recurs and you're like, of course it'll fail. Like how were they thinking? Who were they talking to? Who sold them? And you just, I don't know. I just never got into it, but maybe I think in a former business that I worked at, we were asked if we would consider being one of the, I just went, no way. Like, I just don't want to know about it. Just run away, I said to my boss at the time. But yeah, I've just found the thing about Kevin is he just gets away with the most awkward, confronting questions and comments that I don't think anyone else could. And I don't think I've seen from the local presenters. I don't know who, I don't remember the person's name or that. Like, I feel like it's, you need a Kevin to throw a firecracker into it. And it inspires me to, when I'm talking to people on Buildopedia, I like to think that I can channel a bit of Kevin and throw a firecracker in and ask something that's really awkward and see what happens. And until and no one's left yet. No one's sort of hung up in disgust yet. So anyway, I think I'm finding the balance. But anyway, sorry, I've totally, it's your story. Sorry, let's come
No.
So you started Restorations Australia, which I've watched a few episodes of.
Yeah, so I started on Resto and from there was asked to do Grand Designs Australia, and we're filming the first season now, for my first season now, which should come out in later this year, October-ish, 2024 will be the first one for me. And then in between that, Fremantle Media, who's a production company involved, they kind of came up with a new format which fits sort of in the middle called Grand Designs Transformations, which is this new show which is on right now, which we could talk about if you like, because it's actually raised some really interesting conversations which are very different to the normal kind of conversations, both either from Restoration Australia or from Grand Designs Australia. And that's been interesting, you know. And so, you know, in that spread, there's the heritage story, which is the larger restoration, small piece of Australian heritage being resurrected or saved. Then there's the grand designs, which is the very aspirational. And let's be honest, most of us, we sort of probably can't afford to sort of build the houses that we see on a lot of grand designs, although that is really changing, which I'm really thrilled about, actually. The way we've sort of approached this new season now is to sort of try and look for grand ideas that may be actually small houses, but really big ambitions for a house.
Yeah.
So like you said about the waterproofing a minute ago, actually what I'm looking for is people who are innovators. They want to break the mold. They don't want to do it the way everyone says they should because it's been tried and true and it's been tested and surely. But if you think like me, then you think, well, the way we've been doing it for 100 years is actually broken. It's actually leading us into big, relatively difficult to maintain and expensive homes that actually aren't fit for purpose in the way they should be these days. So we need innovators, and that's what we're looking for there. And that includes things like the sustainability agenda, the cost of living agenda, the new materials that are always arriving on the scene one way or another, and how people are finding ways to latch onto them, employ them, think through them. And of course, there's always the family story. The homeowners themselves are a big, massive part of the story and the process they go through. And I mean, I think you're kind of right when you say, you know, grand designs is a formula. We kind of know what happens. The script is not up. We get it. But what we're really watching is how people are reacting to things that are going to come at them. And I agree with you 1,000%. Like, building is complex. There's a lot to be thinking through and about, and there's a lot of things that can go wrong. A lot of externalities too. So you can only control for so much. So the external environment's always going to throw some curveball at you, whether it's a rock where you didn't expect to find one, or the cost of a material that just blew through the roof, whatever. Like, it's going to be something that's not in your control. And how you respond to that is what I think we are watching a lot of the time. Certainly there are other building shows and around, but we on Grand Designs, we really don't fabricate the drama. We're there to be more of a documentary. You know, we embellish the documentary with some, the drama of the journey, but we're not kind of throwing things in the mix to stitch anyone up or get anyone to sort of, I don't know, break something at the wrong time. There's already enough going on. There's enough of a story there already without us having to do any of that. So that's what I really enjoy about Grand Designs, and particularly the that sense of why not? We should innovate. We should be looking for better ways to do things. That's what I'm sort of hungry with Grand Designs. The Grand Designs Transformations, this is the one that sits in the middle. This is a new format entirely. So it's two projects per episode. And I share the hosting duties with Yasmin Janine, who is an interior designer. She's fantastic. And she has a very different point of view to me, which is that we're basically aligned on, I'd say, 80% of what we see. But there's sort of just that she's just got such a different way of looking at certain things that I find totally fascinating. And I'm loving the conversation we're having. But the thing that's nice about that show is it's really in that renovation space where pretty much anyone sitting on the couch at home can kind of identify with the scale very readily. It's a back room, it's a backyard, it's a pool, it's a carport, it's a bathroom. It's projects which might seem sort of really everyday, but actually that is where so much innovation and work is happening that it's kind of worth pointing the camera in that direction and finding those people who are doing that scale differently. Because again, we need to find those leaders who are willing to take a risk. And as you sort of alluded to earlier on, it is a risk because there's so much money tied up in this. And we as Australians have a huge financial and emotional investment in what we think of as a house. To think of risking any of that is a very brave kind of move. So, you know, the people who come on the show, they're pretty self-selecting. They volunteer to come on the show and so they want to tell a story, and our job, I think, is just to help them tell it.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you've mentioned the fact that your new series, it takes cost of living into account and the environment, because, I mean, I think back to Grand Designs episode and even to some extent restoration episodes, they're very much middle class. Feels like upper middle class, particularly Grand Design. Like, it's a very narrow band of culture and people. And to be fair, I haven't watched every episode. I haven't sort of been into it, but it feels like every time I switched it on, it feels like, yeah, people got a bit of money, it's an indulgence. It's not, they're not solving base level problems, bottom of the pyramid. Like, they're not just trying to make do. They're people who are, who tend to be indulging and putting a bit of money in. So I'm, yeah, and I kind of sometimes I feel that as a professional in the industry, we're in this kind of odd hallucination about what we should be doing and what we are doing, from just how much concrete we're still putting into buildings and how much, like, what we're building and how much we're building. And we kind of know there's a crisis looming. Are we hallucinating a little bit? Are we kind of out of touch as a profession? I mean, I don't know the answer, but it does feel like we're a little, still a way off. So, yeah, I mean, I think I'd love to see a Grand Designs where it's the guy who's been building for 30 years, one brick at a time, like a few, you know, that's what I'd love to see. I remember seeing when I was at school and I caught the train, there was this perpetual build for years and years just off the train tracks. I don't know where it was, somewhere in the western suburbs, and you could see it progressing a few bricks at a time. And that's potentially, that's maybe they were disorganized, maybe that's all they could afford. But I think you kind of, like, I don't want to see another house in Castle Crag, you know, like I want to see the guy who's making do, who's just making do, the couple that are just making do and winging it. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I want to see the whole spectrum. I don't want to see any one type. So, yeah, I'm happy to see the guy who's putting one brick on at a time and doing it for 30 years, as much as I want to see another house in Castle Crag if it's got a great story to tell.
I guess it doesn't make great TV to for 30 years.
Well, it makes very long episodes. But, I mean, thinking about what you're just saying, I mean, I don't agree that the homeowners are all sort of pretentious white middle class in the way that you've characterized them. I think there is a certain sort of price point that is just the reality of building in Australia. So anyone who's doing anything is going to be sort of on a relatively stable income. It's not the those of us or those who are struggling, you know, who are going to be able to do this kind of thing. But I also think what's really been really interesting about, say, something like Restoration Australia, in this last season we had episode 2, Campbell and Caroline out in Pinneroo in South Australia. Campbell bought that church out there when he was 27, he bought it on a credit card. He got 10 grand from his dad, bought the whole thing for 23,000 bucks, I think. And then they spent 7 years doing all the work themselves. And they are the most entrepreneurial young couple who are going to make a mark in Pinneroo, if not bigger, because of that tenacity that they have and their willingness to just throw down at it and go for it. And I was so taken by that kind of spirit that they kind of put out and they were prepared to put on screen for everyone else to sort of be a part of. So that was really good. That was a restoration story. Then the another one that's coming up actually this week on Grand Designs Transformations is a $30,000, a little tiny sort of almost like a granny flat actually in Blackwall near Woi Woi in New South Wales. And that whole house was done basically sourcing materials through Facebook Marketplace. So the entire build, I mean, he was carpenter, the guy who was putting it together, Ash and Jeanette, his wife, they both as a pair were building this little house because she's American and she wants a place for her family to stay when they come out. Again, young people, he's a tradie and now he's working for the council. So he's sort of thinking, yeah, I've got some skills. But then Jeanette, she's clever and she said, well, look, we can't afford to do it the normal way. We've got to rethink the way we source materials. Let's start on the whole sort of upcycling exchange of used materials kind of marketplace routine. And from that, they basically put together this little building, which came from basically everyone's building detritus. What I find fascinating about that, I mean, when you look at it, it's a very cute little thing. It's not going to rock your design world in a way that's going to smash your perceptions of what you can do. But the way they did it, and their attitude going into it has been fantastic, because that's the kind of response to cost of living that I think is both interesting, innovative, resourceful, intelligent, and actually opens a lot of doors to think differently about how we build in this country that might make it just that little bit more accessible to everyone.
Yeah, no, I, look, Absolutely. And I guess I didn't use the word pretentious just for clarity, but I know there's some diversity there, but it's not, my comment was that it doesn't reflect the diversity we have in the country. It does, from my watching, it does tend to be, yeah, wealthier, generally people who want to show something or prove something. But one of my fundamentals is respect for all people. So, you know, it's not about the people or them, but I'm fine. They can show, whether it's their wealth they want to show, good luck. But it's kind of, yeah, skewed. But I guess it has to be because, you're right, those people can afford architecture. But I guess I'm kind of, what I wanted to ask you before I forget is, what you mentioned a couple of episodes. Do you have an all-time favorite? Like, is there an all-time favorite restoration or like one that is a must watch? So you mentioned two. Is it one of them?
Yeah. Oh, look, I don't have a favorite, so I'm not going to nominate one as my kind of like, it's like saying, which of your kids is your favorite? No, I can't do that. but each episode has something different, and I respond better to some things than others, you know. So some of the stories really resonate more with me, for example. So there was a restoration episode called The Miner's Cottage, which was just out in Gordon, just outside of Ballarat in Victoria in the last season, episode number 4. Jess and Chris, and they have little Quincy, came along halfway through the episode, and they, as a young couple, were just such beautiful makers. I wouldn't call them builders as such. They just, everything they did, from gardening to cooking to making wine, they just made everything with this sense of care and craft, which they put into their whole lives. And so when they turned that attention to restoring a little tiny miner's cottage and then doing an addition to it, you know, Jess cracked on and Chris helped. She laid in, you know, and helped out. And the finished product was just beautiful. Beautiful timbers, immaculately finished, really clever details. Even things like, I don't think we showed it on the episode, but there was a concrete slab in the new section and there was a slight little tiny crack developed in just one part of it after it cured a little bit. And rather than try and sort of patch it up with bog or something and then repolish it, they said, oh, let's do the whole trick where you take like gold leaf or something and you highlight the crack and you put that in there and you polish that in. So you actually express the little error, the little fault that's been made. But the way that they did that was gorgeous. And it only added so much richness to the build. It didn't cost them anything, comparatively speaking. It was just clever thinking, beautiful philosophy about making that results in this now a family home, which is, I thought it was, really appealed to me the way they approached that particular project. But look, saying that, that was one. But saying that, there are lots, you know, that have different angles that sort of appeal to me for different reasons. And look, I'm at the moment, I'm covering something like 50 houses that we're looking at as we're filming right now. So that's a lot of work that's going on and a lot of issues coming up, everything from earthships and hempcrete and subterranean houses. And everyone's trying to find a way into the sustainability conversation in terms that make sense to them and their particular circumstances. And, you know, I think all of those things they're all fascinating in their own way.
And just thinking about sustainability, because I've always, like, that's my main comment around a collective, I called it a hallucination, but it just feels like we're not, as a group of professionals, we're just not getting it. We're just not there. We're ignoring something that's looming. And I kind of always, and even I guess as a practice owner, where we're kind of motivated to reduce carbon emissions in building, like, it's not simple, it's not straightforward. Even when you've got a motivated team, at one point I just said, we either do something or we shut up about it. Like, because I've became frustrated with the ongoing kind of, we got to do something about it. It's something that we need to pursue. So I'm teetering between, we either put up or shut up, or do I just declare that, do I just say from now on we do it a particular way and put my foot down? But I'm wondering about your view on it, because it does feel like, you know, you got, and what's commendable is that there are people like Caroline Pidcock who do a lot of work and promote, and I've had her
architects declare.
Declare. But a lot of those architects on that list, you look at their work and you're like, it's not coherent with what you're declaring. Like, you're still pumping a lot of concrete into your buildings. And I'm not going to name any of them because I don't want to do it. That's not the point. But
no.
When you look down the list, you're kind of going, are we in a hallucination? Are we greenwashing? Is it deliberate or we just don't quite know how to get out of what we're doing?
My answer is, firstly, with your own business, I would lean into it. I want to encourage you to lean into the idea of, let's look for better ways to do this. I think to your comment, I don't think we're doing it as well as we can. Absolutely. I think, the way I kind of characterize this is the science happened in the 70s and 80s. The technology followed that in the 90s and noughties. And now it's a question of culture and politics, really. So there is no technical impediment to us actually acting much more cleverly with respect to climate change and what we do in the building industry. It's only that we have a culture of building and a culture of designing and a culture of the market, which is not quite ready to accept these new things just yet because they're a little bit unknown, they're not quite regulated. There's a little bit of risk maybe with a new material that hasn't been proven over 20 years, these kinds of things. In a very risk-adverse building industry that we are, that kind of make them hard. So it's this last little leap that's the last little thing to jump over, I think. But I do think, I've said this before, I think we're at a real tipping point in the Australian house, with respect to the Australian house. I say that because, again, back to the externalities, the climate issues to start with, we simply have to do better than what we're doing right now. The other part is the cost of living. We can't do things with the same amount of money that we have had readily available for the last 20 years, and we have to think differently. We have to think more cleverly. And then I don't think that means designing less. I think it means designing more cleverly to get more out of less. Yeah, and so that's kind of like a philosophy of approach, if you like. And there are all sorts of consequences which flow on from that. And I could just run through and basically reiterate what Carolyn would have said on your podcast with Design Architects Declare. And support that mission. I think the thing that one of the things that I think has come up that's really interesting is we tend to think of this as a kind of a new build story. When I'm building the new house, it's going to be sustainable. I'll put solar on the roof and I'll have water tanks and I'll be peachy. Actually, a great report just recently from ClimateWorks, which is a research group in Monash, attached to Monash University, have made the point very beautifully or very eloquently that actually, really, our sustainable pathways are going to be 80% solved by renovations, not new builds. So the kind of statistics, and I'm going to get this wrong, so don't quote me here, but it's something like 80% of the built fabric that we will have in 2050 already exists today. But most of that was built prior to 2003, when we really started thinking about issues of sustainability and thermal comfort and these kinds of things. So, now we've got regulations, we've got NatHERS, we've got LEED ratings, we've got all sorts of different standards we can look to, BASICS, for example. And they're the kind of first pushes into regulating this space. But when I'm out there talking with homeowners, they've already brought sustainability from the fringe to the center of their thinking. The problem that they're having is that they're not quite sure they want to do it. They definitely want to do it. They feel the ethical, moral charge to make it part of their contribution, but they don't quite know the best way to do it and how to do it. And so I think the danger here is we all are looking for this one single silver bullet. We want the one thing we can do, it's going to solve it all. And that's just never going to happen. Because as we said before, building's complicated. It's complex, lots of bits. So what we need is a kind of a regime or an arsenal of tactics that help us kind of build a sustainable home through multiple things like the insulation, like the material choices, like the size of the house. I mean, we build too big in Australia. We need to shrink the size of our houses. That's kind of well understood on a global perspective. We're just too big and we don't need that space. And so we don't have to, if we have a smaller house, we don't have to heat or cool as big a space, which means our air conditioning loads are smaller, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there are some things that have to happen. Some of them are cultural, some of them are technical, some of them are just from a sort of an implementation point of view. But homeowners themselves, at least in my experience with the people I'm talking to, is very much, we want to do the right thing. We want to find a way into this. How do we do that? I think there are firms out there that will say, yeah, yeah, we're all sustainable. It's all great. Come on board. We'll give you the ratings you need. And you have to be careful because not everyone is straight up about that. It's easy to stick a green, you know, a logo on your business and say, yeah, we're green, and without having done any of the actual work. And I think that's the hard part. To do this work, we do have to flip our heads a little bit and think a little bit differently. And that's hard when we're all struggling to kind of just even keep up with business as usual as it is. So it's not straightforward.
Yeah. But I guess my comment is, as an industry, as a group of people, where if you have a needle on the industry, it's not, and you're right. I mean, it's something that I knew about in the early 90s when I was at uni. Like, it's something that we had to do in the 90s, something we had to do in the 2000s. It's now something we have to do in the 2020s. It's like flying cars. It's always something we have to do one day, but never quite nudges over.
I mean, keep in mind too, it's a big ship, right? We're trying to turn a gigantic industry around a corner. And so we can have a conversation at the level of architecture, which is, what are we designing? We can have a conversation at the level of the Master Builders Association, which is, how are you building? We can have a conversation at the level of the suppliers, which are global infrastructures of supply. And of course, like, all the way all those things intersect. So it's a huge kind of culture we have to sort of turn around on. But I think the main thing, and the reason I'm feeling optimistic at the moment, is because I think people are starting to see, they're committing to it, and they're starting to see ways that they can make small steps in the right direction. And lots of small steps equals the right thing, I think.
Yeah, but I think it's actually inconsistent with the data that we're getting, which actually is now looking more and more dire. So we're actually need, and I'm not a green, I wouldn't identify myself as particularly green. It's just a reality sinking in around the fact that the climate problem is even worse this year than we thought 2 years ago. Like, it's not great. We've underestimated the problem, if anything, and underestimated the unpredictability. We kind of need a firecracker underneath the whole, like, it's those little shifts. I guess the point I'm making is the little shifts add up, but we need to radically turn the ship, because we're heading for an iceberg, or we're heading for some disaster. So it's actually, I'm kind of going, yes, we're doing small things. We're improving the regulations. We're incrementally doing things, but it feels like there's a disconnection, because what's needed is something radical. On an objective level, not in an alarmist level, on an objective level, something radical is required. And this isn't every industry. And some people are onto that, sounding the alarm, like Andrew Forrest, who's really laying into fossil fuel businesses. And as a miner, laying into fossil fuel businesses is unprecedented. But there's people who are kind of going, no. This is actually worse, and we need to turn the ship faster. We need to do something that's more than incremental. And I think, unfortunately, in architecture practices, there's a culture of beating the specs, like getting our clients, because and it's a natural thing, because we want to give our clients what they want, which is quality space, a return on investment. A lot of the time, yes, they want something that reduces their carbon emissions, but in parallel with other things. And I think what's ingrained in architects is how to move around and make things work. So I don't know, I might be rambling a little bit, but I feel like there's still such a disconnect between the reality and where we're still heading, and still designing buildings that are too big, that have too much concrete, that are on the cusp of compliance, whereas we should be pushing past that. And I think it's, as an industry, are we sustainable? Like, are we ever going to be sustainable is something I've thought about.
Two responses there. I mean, one is this ClimateWorks report, the Climate Ready Homes, building the case for a renovation wave in Australia. They make the point that if we just did some really basic upgrades to our existing fabric, we would be able to move Australia's carbon performance towards 1.5 degrees and actually attain that target. That's the claim that's made in that research. So that to me is the first little bit of optimism I've seen from the research community for a little while. So that's great. There's like a way with some simple steps. But I sort of agree with you and disagree with you. I mean, I agree with you in the sense that, yeah, we're never doing enough right now. We're not moving fast enough. But the part where I disagree with you is I think architects have wholesale got on board. Well, I need to qualify that. You know, the architects that I speak to and the people that I'm talking to, certainly around academia and then in practice around Sydney and so on, you know, it's not like it's a the sustainability thing is not something to be avoided or skirted around or somehow cheated. Like it's no, we've got to do it as a profession because, you know, we're being judged by this just like everyone else is. And you've heard the stats like I have, you know, the construction industry contributes 39% to our carbon footprint around the globe. So we're not the whole story, but we're a pretty big chunk of it. And so, yeah, we do need to do what we can do quicker. I think the real issue, though, is this gap between aspiration, which we all have now, and the idea of landing it, you know, how to land that aspiration. So it's in that space that we're currently existing. And that's the complexity of things like regulation. And people want more regulation, people want less regulation, free market, controlled markets. And so we get into that space and suddenly it's not a conversation about sustainability anymore. It's a conversation about politics and other things. Yeah.
So I'm thinking we need to make an emergency landing, just going off the how we land it. Yeah, it needs to be swift and it needs something like I don't know what that is, but it feels like it needs something substantial that is, yeah, I don't know what it is, but it feels like something more than the incremental pace of change and the slow burn. Yeah. Anyway, I don't know. We're not going to work it out right now, I think, Anthony. But I think, yeah, I've been thinking of it for a while. And yeah, like it's very frustrating because even when there's the willpower in a practice, it's like, well, which thing do we do first? And how do we do? And I feel like one day I'm just going to go, right, from this point in time, we only do this. And but that's a risk. That's a business risk. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I think it's the same. Like I can't help thinking that there's a lot of people out there who have the same dilemma. And yes, there's a will, but how do you flip? Where's that switch? Where's the big switch? Where's the nuclear? Not nuclear option in a negative way, but where we need to press that button. You know?
Yeah, but there is no silver bullet.
No.
There's no silver bullet. There's no one thing. So just keep finding the next thing. Keep finding the next thing and do more of it. You know, that's what we can all do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, all right, we'll leave carbon because obviously, I mean, you know, thinking about it a lot, hence I'm rambling about it a lot, but I wanted to depart from there and just think about maybe more generally the future of architecture and what your view of that is. I wrote about it some time ago before even ChatGPT was released, and I found that blog and I shared a draft. I don't know if you managed to get a chance to read it because it was last minute, as things are, but I sort of think that architecture is going to hit an upheaval at some point. And I wonder if architects and their registrations in 2024 are a little bit like the taxi industry and its registrations in 2004, is there a disruption coming from AI unregistered operators who move in and just work around the registration process? I don't know the answer, but it feels like it's a bit of a, I can see similarities. It's a protected, regulated industry, but it's not regulated in a way where if you step out of line, you get brought back into line. And so you've got to be careful about using the word architect if you're not an architect, if you're not registered. But if a group or a platform or someone wants to challenge that, will it stand up or will it fall over the way the taxi industry did when Uber moved in?
It's a big question. Like, we, you know, where is architecture going in the next couple of decades? There are a couple of existential threats on the horizon. AI is one of them. I feel less worried about a kind of disciplinary upheaval in the sense of, you know, people challenging the idea of being a registered architect and so on. I think, you know, that's a piece of legislation. It's a charter that the registration boards defend, if you like, or enact. And I think I still think there's sort of value in that, that people recognize, you know, you're not going to go and just see the witch doctor down on the street corner if you've got something wrong with you. You're going to go and see a doctor, and you're going to go to that doctor because you know that they've got the credentials to give you the right advice. I think it's exactly the same thing with architects. And if anything, it's getting so complex, the building process, that actually you need someone who's got the experience and the training to get you through everything from the design questions through the regulatory questions. And even like we were talking about before with the sustainability stuff, you need someone who knows that space and can operate effectively and intelligently in that space. And that's not just any kind of like, you know, Johnny come lately. Someone needs to have sort of some training there. So I think that's given me reason to think. I don't think that the discipline as such is in any danger. But I do think it's going to change quite a lot. And where this is where AI comes back in. I mean, I was writing about this for an article recently. And yeah, Midjourney, you can put a sentence into a piece of software and come back with a visualization of pretty much any piece of architecture you like. And you can tinker with that and anyone can do it. And that's great to a point. It's great to a point because it's an image. It's not a design. And you and I know the difference there. And, you know, as far as a kind of an ideas generator goes, it's fine. People might actually even loosen up some of the things we think about when we think about ways to live or sort of the sorts of things we want to build. But when it comes to translating those images into an actual, you know, finished piece of architecture, a building, it doesn't just take translation into plans and sections that a machine can do. It takes a kind of a processing that involves all the qualitative dimensions of the design as well as all the social and political dimensions of the industry as a whole. How do you take this information and communicate it effectively to a builder? How do you bring the builder into the conversation? How does the homeowner have a relationship with that? You know, all these things, which I think there will be a lot more automation rather than less in our processes, but I don't think that's going to remove us from the process. I still think we're going to be very necessary. And if anything, actually, hopefully, it will focus the value of where architects work in that kind of chain, if you like, of information flow to let architects do the work that they do best. And that is around, back to the beginning of our conversation, back to the sort of how do we know this is a quality environment for people to live in? You know, how do I assess that, evaluate that, design it better, improve that?
Yeah. But I think, like, I've used Midjourney myself. It's like, it reminds me of dial-up internet in the 90s, you know, like it's very kind of hit and miss and, you know, it's like riding a wild horse. Like it's not, it's got a long way to, like, so it in terms of feeling like dial-up, it's got a long way to go to be reliable and useful, yeah. Right? But I think that 90% of architect just general plans and creation is very algorithmic. And so I think that it's even more adaptable than images. And I think the architect takes on a role of more like a curator, I think, in the future. Like it's very, like if you break down room sizes, stair heights, widths, and if you can feed in, if you get machine learning and feed in all the designs that are possible and they relate that width building and that, because a lot of what architects do is kind of go, this is one of these. I've done this before. I know how to solve it. So it's that experience that is gold. And I think a lot of it can be replicated. So I think it's more like curation. It's more like, okay, AI's come up with 20 different options. We'll bin 18 of them and we'll iterate on two of them. So I think like the future is very much automated. No one knows that for sure, but
I mean, there's a lot of fear in the AI thing as well. You know, like we had the same things way back when, you know, things like the loom was being challenged by the steam engine, for goodness sakes, you know, and people were smashing machines because, you know, they're going to take over the world. And that was like 200 years ago. So I think we have this perpetual kind of fear of that technological evolution. I do agree with you in the sense that the role of the architect will become more curatorial than generative, if I can put it that way. So less of the, you know, the genius architect sitting at her desk with a brilliant idea suddenly springing onto the page, and there's the design, you know. That never happened in the first place, and like it's never going to happen. It's not going to happen tomorrow. And there's a lot of that, just the amount of material or stimulus that can be generated through AI that actually is quite sort of, well, stimulating, you know. It does get you thinking differently, which is a good thing, which puts the role of the architect then into more of a curatorial perspective. But I don't think the story is just that. I mean, you're right. Their architecture is a lot of standards and regulations and things which are absolutely able to be reduced to an algorithmic process, like a staircase width, a stair height, riser, all that sort of stuff. But that's building and not architecture, if I can make that distinction. Putting a staircase in the world and making it actually comply with regulations is great. That's building a staircase. Designing a beautiful way to go from the ground floor to the first floor, that's architecture. And I think there's a qualitative difference between those two things. And I don't think AI has got what it takes, at least just yet, to be able to sort of think beyond the information that's been fed. So, you know, it's an algorithmic process, so it'll work with what it's been given. So if it goes and surveys the whole web, you know, a billion images to create one that it gives to you, it's only ever going to produce something that is a combination of those things. They're going to think outside that box. So I think there's still a lot of space. I'm not sort of nihilistic at this point about where architecture is going with regards to that. But I'm excited is the wrong word. I'm very curious about where architecture will change. And that I agree with, that it will change because of these kinds of technologies. And we're in for more information, more automation, not less.
Yeah, I think that I'm prepared to be, like, from what I've seen happen in the last year, I'm prepared to be surprised by where it can go quickly. And it's just, yeah, what I've seen it do and where I've seen it go from being something of a interesting kind of project that tech companies have invested money into something that is useful every day, I'm just kind of going, I think the future is, for most people, is design by machine.
Yeah. Now, if you think about it, I mean, architects contribute to something like, I'm going to say, 5% of the built outcomes in the world at this point in time. It was 7% a few years back. It's 5% or thereabouts now. So actually, there's 95% of the building stuff that's coming out and being built today that architects have nothing to do with, or which is just rote building. And AI will dominate that space, absolutely. So that other 5%, hopefully we can kind of expand that again to bring architects more into the fold to find the quality that rote automation stuff is going to miss. But if you've just got a regular job, you need to kind of get something through, you know, a local council because you're putting a back room on and you don't really have anything special that you want to do other than worry about resale, then, yeah, AI can just knock something up for you and you're kind of done. But that's not where architects are generally working anyway. So,
Yeah, no, absolutely. Anthony, I realize that we're gone over time, and I appreciate you probably got things to do and episodes to film and a whole bunch of other things. So I think that might be a good place to wrap up. And I certainly just thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate you coming on and being part of Buildopedia. And thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Matt.
Thanks so much for tuning into Buildopedia. If you enjoyed the episode, please give us a rating to help other listeners find our podcast. For more information, please check the show notes and please connect with us on social media. Love to hear from you. Goodbye for now.
You've been listening to Buildopedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, buildopedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.